Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, episode 4.66, The Siege of Yorktown. Welcome back. Before we get into the battle for today, I want to take care of a couple quick housekeeping measures first. Now, as I had mentioned a few weeks back, I will be wrapping up the revolution with Yorktown. The war is technically going to continue for another 2 years, while a treaty gets hammered out. However, following Yorktown, I want to shift our focus away from the question of the war, and more into the question of, now that the Americans had won the war, what were they going to do next? We are going to have one more episode in 2 weeks where we discuss exactly how Yorktown became, well, Yorktown, to wrap up this season's narrative. Following that, we are going to do things a little differently than we have in the past. Traditionally, this has been where I move us into our season reviews. This season, though, I have decided to try something new. I'm going to level with all of you. I hate our seasons in review. They are the most boring episodes for me to write, and the listener statistics don't support that you like them much more than I do. Plus, logistically, this season is going to be 67 episodes long. There simply is no way that I can summarize 67 episodes into half-hour episodes. So, what I want to do instead is to take the opportunity to look back and see what conclusions we can reach. Rather than a review, I want this to act as more of a bookend, to tie everything that we have spoken about together this season. This episode is going to help synthesize everything we have talked about and try to make sense of what it all had meant. So, hopefully this process works better and we get a bit more out of it. Now, with that, let's go ahead and head back to Yorktown and see how all of our old friends are doing. When George Washington marched out of Williamsburg on September 28th, it all but sealed the fate of Cornwallis and his army. The 28th was not exactly some death blow to Cornwallis. In fact, little actually happened on that day. Rather, it marks that moment where a string of bad decisions transformed into an unescapable eventuality. This chain of events had begun back at the end of July, when Clinton had ordered Cornwallis to establish a harbor on a piece of land that was tailor-made to trap an army. Surrounded on three sides by rivers and only connected to the mainland via a narrow neck, the safety of Cornwallis and the British largely depended on the ability of the British Navy to control the mouth of the Chesapeake. Should the French fleet gain control over the James and the York River, and the Continental Army manage to control the neck, well, then Cornwallis would have very few options. This is, of course, exactly what happened, when on September 5th, the French fleet, commanded by Admiral de Grasse, fought an otherwise close battle, but he did manage to run the British out of the Chesapeake. A second French fleet, under the Comte de Barras, slipped into the now empty rivers and cut off any escape by the water. When Washington marched out on September 28th, it cut off any remaining hope, even if that hope was already very slim by this point, of Cornwallis being able to fight his way through the American lines. Cornwallis was now very much trapped. Although the Battle of Yorktown is something that finds itself now deeply rooted in the American ethos of great battles, the situation was always rather bleak for Cornwallis. We will talk about his defensive positions here in a moment, but suffice it to say that the Franco-American forces had a clear advantage, controlling both the land and water-based routes around Yorktown, trapping Cornwallis inside. In terms of sheer manpower, Washington held a huge advantage over his adversary. The Americans had some 16,000 men, compared to just around 7,000 for the British. Moving out from Williamsburg and crossing the neck towards Yorktown, the Americans under Washington's command took up a position on the right of the field, with the French under Rochambeau on the left. The army took a few hours to get into position, but by the middle of the day on the 28th, both the French and the Americans were in the field and had, more or less, reached their destinations a few miles away from the British lines. Yorktown itself was little more than a sleepy village, The east of the town was bordered by the York River. Much of the surrounding area to the northwest, south, and southwest were marshlands. Two small creeks made their way through the village, out to the York, running just north of the main village. In the south, there was Pigeon Hill, which was a slightly elevated, heavily forested patch of land. The real advantage of Yorktown was in its close proximity to Gloucester. Both Yorktown and Gloucester jut out into the river, forming a narrow point. Here, the river was only about half a mile wide. Both to the north and the south of this particular point, the river quickly widens to around 2 miles across. The plan for Washington was not going to be a direct assault on Yorktown, but rather it was going to be a siege. To this point in the war, we really have seen very few sieges conducted by either side. Back during the French and Indian War, sieges had been the norm, and we spent countless weeks talking about the process of digging those parallel trenches. However, during the Revolution, we have only really seen a few instances of sieges taking place. The majority of these came in the south, as British garrisons were ejected from their backcountry footholds. For the most part, Washington and the Americans were eager not to get pinned down in any one place. Washington had become a master of escaping from tight spaces, much to the vexation of the British commanders. Washington understood that if the American army got stuck besieged in, say, for example, Philadelphia, it could lead to the destruction of the army and consequently the American cause. In his calculations, therefore, there was no one critical location that was so worth preserving that he would allow the American army to get stuck. Although somewhat more common in the South, sieges just never really became a core part of this particular war. With all that being said, it is impossible to deny that Yorktown was a situation tailor-made for a siege. The French Navy had control of the rivers, and the combined Franco-American armies had closed off the escape through the neck. Bunker Hill and the Battle of Quebec years before had proven the cost of attacking a fortified location, and with Cornwallis essentially hemmed in, it isn't like he was going anywhere. Lord Cornwallis could really do little more at this point than hunker down behind his fortifications and scan the horizon for Clinton, and that promised relief party that he was desperately clinging to hope of. Cornwallis's defenses in Yorktown were made up of two lines, an outer and an inner layer of defense. The outer defenses were made up of three redoubts, located some 1,200 yards from Yorktown itself, in an area referred to as the Pigeon Quarter. Beyond that first line of defense was the inner line of defenses located some 300 to 400 yards from Yorktown. That inner line of defenses were far from complete, however, and even as the French and Americans began the process of putting the noose around Cornwallis's neck, they were racing to complete the inner defenses, which still did require extensive work. The inner line of defense was shaped roughly as a crescent, running around the town with the river marking the anchor points. Just 2 days into the battle, on September 30th, Cornwallis would make a decision that remains controversial to this day. Fighting had begun on the 29th, the day after the Americans had marched out of Williamsburg, mostly in the form of artillery duels, something that will become a common feature of this particular battle. Both sides took some minor damage, with the British seeing some 30 or so casualties. Now, on the surface, this first day of fighting was really nothing more than an exchange of some fire. Now, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time detailing the battle because really, not much happened. This was a harassing fire more than anything else. Nothing about this was terribly controversial. What was controversial, however, is what happened that night. That night, Cornwallis made the fateful, and frankly baffling, decision to abandon the majority of that outer line of defense, specifically those defenses that were located in the Pigeon Quarter. He did maintain some of his outer defenses closer to the river. However, for the most part, he pulled his men back into the inner defenses. In his book, Victory at Yorktown, Richard Ketchum writes that in the aftermath of this decision, both the French and the American officers spent a significant amount of time trying to figure out exactly what Cornwallis was doing. At the moment, however, what was abundantly clear is that Cornwallis had just given up a substantial amount of his defensive capabilities, allowing the Americans to close in much closer to Yorktown than they would have otherwise been able. Cornwallis's prospects were already bleak before he decided to abandon his outer defenses. However, this went a very long way to officially sealing his fate. I want to therefore spend a couple of minutes to talk about what was going through the mind of Cornwallis at this point. It is important to remember that we have hindsight that Cornwallis simply was lacking, seeing as how he was living in the moment, and we are reviewing his actions from the safety of 240 or so years in the future. Specifically to that point, Cornwallis fully believed that a rescue was coming. On September 24th, he received a letter from Clinton, a letter which had been penned just a week earlier, assuring him that they were not just going to hang him out to dry. This was no vague promise of relief either, but rather was a specific plan of action. Clinton let Cornwallis know that a council of war agreed, and that by October 5th, the British fleet under Admiral Graves would be coming back, along with another 5,000 troops to save him. Now, we know that Clinton is not coming. There would be no attempt to rescue Cornwallis and the Southern Army. As it would turn out, during that early September battle with the Grasse, the British fleet had suffered much more damage than anybody had initially realized. Cornwallis never knew that this rescue had been called off. The entire time he was making decisions as though an army was on the way to help him. The result of this is that every single decision being made by Cornwallis is predicated upon his belief that a rescue was coming and was indeed imminent. His primary job, therefore, was just to survive long enough that he could be bailed out. As the Americans and French moved into position on the 28th, Cornwallis was left with several key concerns. He was not really expecting a siege, and therefore was caught somewhat flat-footed when it became clear what the plan was. As soon as Cornwallis figured out what was coming, he worked to throw up defenses against a potential siege. They built earthworks, destroyed vegetation, and cut down trees. However, by September 30th, these defenses were still very much a work in progress. Although Cornwallis did possess some artillery, he really had few other advantages. With Cornwallis realizing that his main objective needed to be defensive in nature, essentially surviving long enough for Clinton to come reach him, he worried that his outer defensive lines were especially vulnerable. Although Clinton would later attack this decision by Cornwallis, probably rightfully, Cornwallis was worried that those outer defensive works were too far from their redoubts to be adequately supported. With the outer works still incomplete and potentially ill-supported, Cornwallis made the decision to pull back and focus all of his efforts on the inner lines. This would significantly shorten the front that the British were going to be required to defend, and hopefully, the more concentrated distribution would prevent any attempt at an outright assault on their position. This was a catastrophic miscalculation by Cornwallis. The first problem is one of logistics. Although it meant that Cornwallis had less of a front to worry about and could better concentrate his men, it also meant that the Americans were now that much closer to the town. Those outer defenses had been some 1,200 yards away from the British position, whereas the inner defenses ranged from 300 to 400 yards. By abandoning those outer defenses, it meant that when the Americans managed to get their first line dug in and themselves begin their bombardment of Yorktown, they would be doing it from far less of a distance, making everything that much more accurate and therefore devastating. Rather than the Americans having to worry about spreading out their fire over a larger area, they now had the ability to concentrate a huge amount of firepower into a much smaller target. The second thing that we must consider is timing. We know that as Washington marched on the 28th, Cornwallis still firmly believed that Clinton was coming to rescue him. Had Cornwallis held on to those forward locations, the Americans would have had to deal with them either through a direct assault or via a siege. The actual method that they would have chosen to take those forward works is not really relevant to this discussion. However, what is relevant is that the Americans never even had to worry about this, because Cornwallis gave them up without a fight. What Cornwallis did not know is that the French fleet was operating with a deadline. In the days immediately preceding Washington marching out of Williamsburg, there had been a real question of if the French Navy under de Grasse was going to stick around at all. And then, even if they did, how long did they plan to stay? Admiral de Grasse was not exactly thrilled at the prospect of moving into the York River. He worried that operations in such a confined area would threaten the French fleet. De Grasse personally wanted to abandon the Chesapeake altogether, and, to what I can only imagine was an eye roll of epic proportions by Washington, sail north to New York. This would have made the relief of Cornwallis far more possible, and may well have doomed the siege before it could even be established. Rochambeau likewise was not amused by the plan, and in polite terms told de Grasse that his plan to go to New York was an unnecessary hazard. So it was not until September 27th, the day before Washington marched on Yorktown, that Lafayette convinced de Grasse to remain in the Chesapeake. Even with this, however, de Grasse was not planning to stay indefinitely, stating that his orders were for him to leave on October 15th, but that he would agree to remain, albeit reluctantly, until the end of the month. Of course, it is impossible for us to know what would have happened had Cornwallis held on to those forward positions. It might not have made any difference at all. Although it is interesting to think about the possibility that had he held out throughout October, maybe de Grasse decides to tap out. Even if he did, it might not have signaled the end of the operation against Cornwallis, but it would have at least given the cornered British a small glimmer of hope. But this is not what is going to happen. Cornwallis gave up the position, the Americans closed in, and began working on digging their siege lines. As dismal as the situation seemed for Cornwallis, there did remain one Hail Mary option to get out of his predicament. We have talked about the fact that the bulk of his army was in Yorktown, but recall that he still did have a small force across from Yorktown in Gloucester. Now, although it was just 700 men, Bannister Tarleton's small force in Gloucester was the last best chance for the British to escape. To be clear, this was far more of an emergency escape hatch for Cornwallis than it was anything else. Utilizing this option required several things to go perfect for Cornwallis. First, it was going to require that he move his army across the York River to Gloucester, which consequently meant avoiding the French fleet. Second, it depended on Tarleton's lanes of escape remaining open. As for the first part of that equation, the avoidance of the French fleet currently controlling the Chesapeake, we know that de Grasse was uncomfortable operating in the narrow confines of the York River, not wanting to get himself inadvertently trapped in the river. Although de Grasse would remain in the Chesapeake, sealing it off, it likewise meant that Cornwallis would have at least some freedom to move between Yorktown and Gloucester, should he attempt to make a run for it. Now, it is not as though Washington and Rochambeau had somehow missed this obvious back door. In fact, the opposite was true. Washington realized that if he was going to establish a siege, he needed to close this potential hole. On October the 3rd, this is exactly what Washington set out to accomplish. In Gloucester, Tarleton had only around 700 men. However, they were not completely without defenses. They had an established line, featuring three batteries, four redoubts, and, most importantly, 19 mounted cannon. The first American force sent to attempt to encroach on this position was George Weedon and the Virginia Militia. Weedon, a brigadier general who had retired from the army following Germantown, had re-entered the fight when the British entered Virginia. During that first encounter, it was anything but encouraging. The British opened fire from those 19 guns, which would quickly convince the Americans That storming a fortified location just did not sound like that fun of a time. However, the Virginia militia was not alone in this attack. As the militia was quickly pulling back, the Duke de Luzerne arrived on the scene. Now, this is the same Duke de Luzerne who we had seen months earlier show up a few days late for that assault on New York. Now, though, he was very much on time. The situation that he stumbled into was the Virginians fleeing in fear, stating that Tarleton was actively pursuing them. This was indeed a very valid fear because it is exactly what was happening. Luzerne, though, rather than retreating, pushed forward, and quickly he discovered that the British cavalry was really just right down the road. A cavalry that was nearly triple the size of his own. Okay, so this is clearly where Luzerne decides to turn around and get out of Dodge. Surely he isn't going to do something crazy like, I don't know, throw caution to the wind and charge a far larger cavalry. Right? Well, no, that is actually exactly what Luzerne did. He charged forward, heading directly at Bannister Tarleton. Tarleton himself, not interested in backing down, likewise moved directly at Luzerne. Before the men could reach each other, however, a spear thrown from the French hit a British cavalry horse, which proceeded itself to fall and in the process take out the very horse that Tarleton was riding. Although the British were able to prevent his capture, the confusion allowed the French to form ranks and send over a volley of fire. The British would make a couple more attempts to break out, but the French now held the advantage and were able to repulse the British attempts. It was during one of these attempts that Tarleton himself was wounded. The French managed to push the British back to the tip of Gloucester Point. Luzerne and Whedon took up positions in Gloucester and ensured that the British were not going anywhere. I do want to mention that at this point, Cornwallis was not actually thinking about leaving through Gloucester. In fact, I cannot find anything where his reaction to Tarleton getting pinned down is stated. However, at this moment on October 3rd, I'm not sure that it would have been that big of a deal. The battle was going more along the lines of a big skirmish than it was some decisive engagement. Tarleton had taken losses to be sure, counting some 50 casualties, as well as numerous men captured. It would still be several weeks until the events of that October 3rd defeat would become so much more of a headache for Cornwallis. Ironically, much of the next week, following the fighting in Gloucester, would not be marked by its activity, but rather by an often baffling passivity. There was some skirmishing, and the British did continue to harass the Americans, in a, as of yet, one-sided artillery duel. During the week, the Americans and the French were very busy as they dug trenches necessary for a siege. This was something of an odd moment for George Washington. Although he was the overall commander of the mission, he understood that his expertise was not in siegecraft. The French had mastered the siege centuries earlier. They knew the process of how to make it work. Washington, therefore, understood his role was not necessarily to run the siege itself, and he found himself deferring to the French leadership on the question of how to actually conduct a siege. This was an unusual role for a man who had been something of a micromanager throughout most of the war. For nearly the first 2 weeks, the Allied troops had been busy digging trenches and dodging British artillery. The British guns posed a serious threat, even if they did prove to be inaccurate. In one instance, Alexander Hamilton, back with the army following a temporary falling out with Washington, marched his troops out to where they were exposed to the British cannon fire, and then had them perform maneuvers. Both at the time and now, there seems to be a general agreement that this was a pointless risk and something that Hamilton should rightly be criticized for. This, however, does show some of that growing confidence of the Americans in their current situation. Rather than cowering behind their entrenchments, they were performing these grand displays. This all being said, it is also worth noting that Rochambeau was quick to put a stop to any similar pointless vain bravado building activities amongst the French. The one-sided artillery duel came to an end on October 9th. After nearly 2 weeks of digging, the first parallel was complete. The battery is established, and the Allies were ready to return fire. George Washington lit the fuse of the first shot from the Americans. From this moment until the end of the battle, the Americans and the French worked diligently to pound the British into submission. Just 2 days later, the second parallel was started, just 300 yards away from the British lines. Here, though, there was a problem. You see, most of the forward positions had been abandoned by Cornwallis. However, there remained a pair of redoubts, specifically Redoubt 9 and 10, that were still a problem. Located to the south of Yorktown, near the river, these two locations were directly in the path of the second parallel. They were in the way, and they needed to be cleared. The plan was to split the task up. The French would take care of Redoubt No. 9, and the Americans were in charge of capturing Redoubt No. 10. The decision was made that the attack would come on the night of October 14th. Washington could have chosen here to pound the two locations into submission via a bombardment, but instead decided on a direct assault. This moment of aggression by Washington likely has much to do with the knowledge that there was a ticking clock on the mission. At some point, de Grasse was going to leave, greatly increasing the possibility of rescue for Cornwallis. Armed with that knowledge, the order of the day was a direct assault. Originally, the mission to take Redoubt No. 10 was not given to Hamilton, but rather to Jean-Joseph Sabard de Jumet, the personal assistant of Lafayette. Hamilton, who was desperate for some battlefield glory, appealed to Washington that he outranked Jumet. Washington acquiesced on the matter, and Hamilton had his command. The plan was that when night fell on the 14th, the assault would be signaled by the Americans firing several shots into the air. The French would end up getting the worst of this engagement, facing stiff resistance as they stormed Redoubt No. 9. The British had constructed an abatis around both redoubts, but it seemed as though the one around Redoubt No. 9 may have been better constructed. The sharpened sticks did much to slow down the French advance, making them easy targets for the British defenders. American sappers were able to move ahead of the rest of Hamilton's columns and clear out the obstacles with far less trouble. The approach was meant to be as stealthy as possible. Both the French and the Americans had been ordered to remove the rounds from their muskets and approach using bayonets only, in order to maintain an element of surprise. Once the Americans had gotten through that abatis, that was really it. Hamilton's men flooded into the fort, and very quickly it fell under American control. Joseph Plum Martin would write of a harrowing, vivid approach, but that once the Continentals made it inside of the redoubt, things quickly fell silent. Martin was not wrong in his assessment that things quickly fell silent. In fact, the entire thing had only taken around 10 minutes. Once the Americans had gained control over the redoubt, Hamilton acted quickly to pour cold water on any ideas that the troops may have had of exacting revenge on the now captured British. Other than an amusing story of Alexander Hamilton briefly diving behind Henry Knox when the British had fired a shell in their direction, and Knox chiding Hamilton not to use him as a breastwork in the future, the Americans took the redoubt with little trouble and few casualties. The French, for their trouble, took their objective as well. However, they suffered significantly more casualties in the process. Either way, this assault had successfully paved the way for the completion of the second parallel, and indeed, by the next morning, the trenches included the two new redoubts. By this point, things were dire for Cornwallis, and he knew it. Even before the Franco-American forces had taken the two redoubts, the situation inside of Yorktown was anything but ideal. Since October 9th, the batteries that were facing Yorktown had been going nearly nonstop. The town itself had been completely destroyed, with many of the residents who remained in the town trying to find protection in natural caves near the river. Among those who relocated to a cave was Cornwallis himself. Food shortages were, as they so often were during a siege, a serious problem. Adding icing to the cake was that disease, specifically smallpox, was now spreading throughout the British camp. So much of the British fortifications at Yorktown had been constructed by African Americans. Many of these people are the same who had, over the course of the war, escaped their bondage to fight for the British under promises of emancipation at the end of the war. Cornwallis wrote to Charles O'Hara when he first arrived in Yorktown that he was in the need of as many Africans as he could get his hands on to build his fortifications, as the heat was simply too oppressive for his soldiers. Even before Yorktown, though, Cornwallis had never shown much in the way of restraint when it came to dealing with the black population working for him. Before leaving Portsmouth for Yorktown, he had left droves of sick African Americans behind. He didn't have the food to feed them, didn't want to introduce more disease into his camp, and they were too ill to work. They held little value to him. This decision to leave them in Portsmouth was little more than revoking the promises made to those unfortunate people. They had agreed to fight for and support the British in exchange for their emancipation. Now, however, that their presence was no longer of value to Cornwallis and the British, they were left behind to their fates. In the final days of the Battle of Yorktown, the situation would repeat itself. Food had always been scarce, and early in the battle, the British were forced to kill thousands of horses, as there was no food for them to eat. These animals, upon their slaughter, were unceremoniously tossed into the river. The men fared a little better, and although the food stores were not outright exhausted, the food that they were eating was often spoiled and infested with worms. Although starvation never set in amongst the British, they certainly were not eating well. The water supply was likewise often bad and added to the misery inside of the British camps. As though this was not enough, the direction of the tides meant that many of those horses that had been just tossed into the river were now washing back up in huge piles on the shores outside of Yorktown. By the time of the seizure of those two redoubts, the British were hungry, sick, and exhausted from the almost non-stop barrage. Here again, Cornwallis, with the stated interest of conserving food, cut loose many of those African Americans who had been so instrumental in building his defenses. By this point, though, they had just become extra mouths to feed, extra vectors of disease. At least one doctor for the Continental Army suspected that Cornwallis was using these people to spread smallpox into the American and French camps. Regardless of his motivations, these people had risked so much personally for their own personal freedom. Now, they were being marched right back to an uncertain future that all but assuredly meant a return to bondage. In the pre-dawn hours of October 16th, Cornwallis made a last attempt at an offensive in Yorktown. Around 350 British troops under Lieutenant Colonel Robert Abercrombie attacked a small French garrison. They were able to overcome the French and quickly gain control over a portion of the trenches and spike cannons in a now undefended battery. They quickly then moved on and engaged an American battery under the leadership of a Captain Savage. The commotion was overheard by the nearby Comte de Noailles, the brother-in-law and close friend to the Marquis de Lafayette. Noailles and his grenadiers were quickly able to jump in short order beat back the British. Other than a handful of casualties on both sides, nothing about this final British attempt came close to changing the situation for Cornwallis. It was little more than a final gasp of air of an increasingly beleaguered British army. Cornwallis would make a final attempt that night to break out. The plan had been to move the army from Yorktown to Gloucester, and then break through the Allied lines before marching overland to New York. If Clinton was not going to rescue him, maybe they could do a speed run to Clinton and the relative safety that New York could provide. If this entire plan seems to be fraught with problems, well, yeah, it was. It can be fun to think about what would have happened if Cornwallis had pulled off such an audacious escape. Yet, really, his army was hungry, exhausted, and sick. He would still have to fight his way through the American lines, and then, with an exhausted army, march hundreds of miles overland to New York. All of this assumes that the Americans and the French do absolutely nothing to stop the British escape. The plan was doomed before it even began. Weather would ultimately play the decisive role in this final desperate attempt, denying us answers for just how things would have played out for the British. Cornwallis was able to move around 1,300 men across the river before a storm rolled in and ended any hope of attempting a breakout in Gloucester. Those who had made it across the York River before the storm reported back that they had insufficient strength to attempt to break through Allied lines. Cornwallis, recognizing the situation for what it was, wrote to Clinton that it was all over. He was not going to sacrifice any more men. Shortly after dawn on October 17th, 1781, a drummer appeared across the British lines, along with an officer holding up a white handkerchief. The battlefield quickly fell silent as the moment was lost on nobody. Lord Cornwallis was ready to negotiate his surrender. The letter addressed to George Washington was short, proposing a 24-hour ceasefire to work out terms. At around 4:30 that afternoon, Cornwallis sent his proposal to the American general. Negotiations would continue throughout the night, and by the next morning, the terms were becoming clear. Although, on the whole, the Americans were not seeking revenge against the British, there was a particular point made that the British should receive the same honors of war that were granted to Benjamin Lincoln the year before in Charleston, which is to say, none at all. The British were to surrender without the honor of flying their flags or marching to their drummers playing a British march. Humiliating or not, Cornwallis had little choice in the matter and begrudgingly accepted. On the morning of October 19th, the Allies signed the terms and sent them to Cornwallis. Washington expected them to be signed by 11 a.m. and for the surrender ceremony to begin at around 2 p.m. The British, about an hour later than Washington had wished, began the official ceremony. Cornwallis himself was not personally present for the surrender, claiming to be sick. Well, it is probable that he was faking. Historian Woody Holton does point out that disease was rampant in Yorktown during those final weeks, so it is at least within the realm of possibility that Cornwallis was indeed sick. On the day, though, it was Charles O'Hara leading the British Army through the proceedings. O'Hara mistakenly, or perhaps completely intentionally, attempted to surrender to Rochambeau. However, the French general was having none of it, directing O'Hara over to Washington. Washington, for his part, recognizing the slight by Cornwallis, refused to accept O'Hara's sword, and instead directed him to his second-in-command, the aforementioned Benjamin Lincoln. The British surrender at Yorktown saw the Americans come into possession of a huge number of firearms and artillery pieces. Nearly 8,000 soldiers and sailors were now American prisoners. On October 17, 1777, the British under John Burgoyne suffered their largest loss to date in the American Revolution. 4 years to that date, the British would announce their intention to surrender Yorktown. Just as Saratoga had so profoundly changed the war in 1777, so would Yorktown in 1781. As we know now, it would be the final major engagement of the American War of Independence. Next time, we are going to pick up our story right at the end of the Battle of Yorktown and examine the immediate aftermath, both in the United States and abroad. We will look at exactly how the Battle of Yorktown would come to mark the end of major campaigns in the United States, and why traditionally it has marked the end of the American Revolution. Until then, I hope you all have a fantastic 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as we wrap up the American Revolution.